Section 2, Potential PAYE Failures. Part 1 of this year's Payroll Year-End Podcast covered the completion and submission of the P38A Employer Supplementary Return, which is required to report details of any worker who has been employed, but where the employer has not submitted a P14 end-of-year summary or completed and retained a student form P38S. On the CPD Master Course, I have covered the issue in more detail and want to discuss it in more depth with you today. HMRC's Employer Help Book E13 tells us that an employee is anyone who is employed under a contract of services, and that this includes someone who is a full-time, part-time, and even a casual worker. It says that if the employee does not give you a P45 because they claim to be self-employed, you should look at the terms on which you took them on, and if you are in any doubt, ask your HMRC tax office for help. Of course, many employers will be sceptical about doing this, and indeed might be very reluctant to contact HMRC at all. The guidance does say that we must treat them as an employee in the meantime. There is a minimum recording requirement for PAYE, where employers must keep at least a record of the name, the address, and the amount of wages paid to each of the workers in each of the pay periods. PAYE threshold for 2010-11 is £125 per week, or £540 per month. But what we must remember is that this is effectively reduced to just £1 if a new employee, including any casual workers, has not provided a P45 from their former employer or completed a P46, ticking either box A or box B. Any worker that ticks box C on the P46, which confirms that they have another job, or perhaps a state or occupational pension, should have been taxed on code basic rate with 20% tax deductions on every pound earned in 2010-11. The complete absence of a P45 or P46 would also demand that tax at the basic rate was deducted from any payments made. There also needs to be adequate controls in place, and it is not acceptable to pay casual labour through petty cash without keeping the required records. The name, the address, and the amount paid each pay period. I've also seen payments to casual labour hidden in expenses, which is even worse than its usual home of petty cash. Wherever these costs are posted, the minimum details must be recorded. It is not good enough to complete a petty cash slip with a note of casual labour, and not even the name of the recipient. HMRC will not accept that the employer does not know who the person is that they are paying. How many businesses would be prepared to employ a stranger and allow a stranger on their premises with the potential risk to their staff and their customers? Another concern that I've been discussing with AAT members at branch meetings and on the CPD courses is the Home Office checks required on workers' entitlement to work in the UK, where potentially severe fines and even prison sentences could be imposed for failing to keep the appropriate paperwork and potentially employing, therefore, illegal workers. I have also seen examples of petty cash payments being made as top-up payments to existing employees, where they've been receiving untaxed overtime or bonuses. This is potentially very serious and could result in the employer being prosecuted. Certainly, the failure to record and report where required payments to casual labour could prove very expensive. HMRC will seek to recover basic rate tax on the full amount of any casual labour payments, plus perhaps 23.8% Class 1 national insurance contributions on any amounts in excess of the earnings threshold. To this will be added interest and penalties. And as I say, this could prove very, very costly. Well, what type of payments do we need to consider? Window cleaners are normally accepted by HMRC as being self-employed, where they, of course, provide their own ladders and other equipment to clean the windows. Office cleaners will be regarded as employees. Do we have, or can we get, assigned P46, which would eradicate or minimise the potential liability? And do we need to put them on the payroll before we close it down? Casual bar staff are often picked up by HMRC, working in pubs, clubs, etc. And very often, they are supplementing their full-time jobs. Therefore, even if a P46 were provided, it would be box C that should be ticked, if accurately completed. Tax should then be deducted at the basic rate. Casual labour may be used by different businesses covering different types of work, but the pay-as-you-earn requirements need to be adhered to, whatever the industry or type of work. What about payments to other workers that may have been brought in to provide cover or help with a big job? Sometimes I see payments to children of directors or of employees that are paid through petty cash. If they are under 16, and we should have proof of their age, then Class 1 NICs will not be an issue, because neither they nor the employer will be liable to Class 1 NICs. They may still be liable to income tax, although their income is unlikely to exceed the personal tax allowance limit, currently 6475. But I would still get assigned P46 from the teenager. Next, let me look more closely at employing student labour, where the P38S procedure might apply, but this cannot and should not be taken for granted. The P38S student employee form is the statutory return that does not have to be submitted to HMRC annually, but there is a statutory requirement to complete this form every year and to retain the completed form for at least 3 closed tax years. Completion of the P38S form allows an employer to pay a student employee without deducting income tax on any earnings up to the personal allowance limit of 6475 in 2010-11, increasing to 7475 next year, and we've just been told in the budget that it will increase to £8,105 in 2012-13. The P38S student form is only relevant to student employees who work for an employer in the school holidays. Student employees must be asked to sign the form when they're first employed. They must complete the student declaration, providing details of their name, their home address and national insurance number, plus their school or college details. They must confirm that they are a student and that they will be until the following 5th of April. And also that their total earnings will not exceed £6,475. Only if the P38S is completed can the employer operate code NT, thereby not deducting any income tax at any time in the tax year. As I've been talking to AAT members at the branches and CPD courses recently, I've been making the point that I've always had a concern and so often found the mistake made that the forms are just not completed. Well, what should we check before closing down the 2010-11 payroll? Firstly, have the P38S forms been completed? Next, has any student been paid more than the £6,475 personal allowance limit? If they were, code OT on a week 1 or month 1 basis should have been applied to any amount in excess of £6,475. Remember, the P38S procedure is not relevant if payments are made to students that work in term time, outside of the school holidays. So do we need to obtain a signed P46 from any such student? And do we need to make any adjustments to the payroll? The P38S procedure is also not relevant to Class 1 NICs, which are due if the student's earnings exceed the earnings threshold. So do we need to check and make any adjustment for Class 1 NICs? However, Class 1 NICs are not due from any student employee under the age of 16. But as I said earlier, can we prove that they were under the age of 16 when we paid them? Finally, another point to remember at the payroll year end is to get the student that is working over the Easter period, which crosses two tax years, to complete another P38S for the 2011-12 tax year. In the earlier podcast, I mentioned termination payments briefly, where I always recommend a year-end check of any tax-free payments made in the year that is about to close. There are a number of issues to consider, starting with whether it was correct to make the payment without deducting income tax or Class 1 NICs. I will always tell you that it is wrong to assume that a termination payment will automatically attract the £30,000 income tax exemption in Section 401 of ITPA 2003, and also that they are not earnings for Class 1 NICs purposes. Genuine compensation or damages should be exempt within that £30,000 limit for income tax, and there should be no NICs liability, although in fact there is no exemption for Class 1 NICs purposes. The payments are either earnings which are liable to Class 1 NICs, or they are outside the definition of earnings and therefore no NICs liability arises. At the CPD Master Course, I used the example of a football manager who, according to the newspapers, was reportedly to have received £7 million compensation when sacked. Using the assumption that this was paid after the date of leaving, he would have probably been paid £7 million less tax on the excess over £30,000, in other words, 20% tax charge on £6,970,000. But there would have been no NICs liability whatsoever if the whole of the £7 million payment was non-contractual, compensation or damages, and therefore not earnings for NICs purposes. However, if there was a contractual entitlement to the element that comprised the payment in lieu of notice, that element would have been liable to both income tax and Class 1 NICs. Payments in lieu of notice and ex gratia payments are a potential minefield for employers, and it is therefore best to seek advice and perhaps clearance from HMRC before making such payments gross and without deducting income tax or NICs. The HMRC non-statutory clearance procedure can be useful for this purpose. I am happy to assure you that any statutory redundancy payments will come within the Section 401 income tax exemption and that they will not be earnings for Class 1 NICs purposes. The maximum statutory redundancy pay that anyone could have received in 2010-11 was £12,000. That is based on 20 years service multiplied by 1.5 weeks, in other words 30 weeks, times the £400 statutory redundancy pay figure that kicked in on the 1st of February 2011. It was previously £380 per week. However, an employee earning less than £400 a week, say earning £300 per week, would receive only £300 times 30 weeks or £9,000, they would not receive the full £400 statutory figure. The point that I must make here is that the exemption applies to genuine statutory redundancies. They would not apply if an employee retired and was given a payment, even if it was described as statutory redundancy pay. The definition of redundancy in Section 139 of the Employment Rights Act 1996 states the following. An employee who is dismissed shall be taken to be dismissed by reason of redundancy if the dismissal is attributable wholly or mainly to the fact that his employer has ceased or intends to cease to carry on the business for the purposes of which the employee was employed by him or has ceased or intends to cease to carry on that business in the place where the employee was employed. Or the fact that the requirements of that business for employees to carry out work of a particular kind, or for employees to carry out work of a particular kind in the place where he was so employed, have ceased or diminished or expected to cease or diminish. Basically, that means that the job's gone. Either the job's gone because they've shut down, or the job's gone because they've moved from the area and the employee's no longer employed. The definition does not cover an employee retiring or leaving and being replaced. It should be applied whether the redundancy payments are statutory or non-statutory redundancy. But it is when an employer decides to top up the payments with non-statutory redundancy payments that we have to think about the £30,000 exemption limit. In carrying out an end-of-year check, I'm also concerned to ensure that any payment described as a non-statutory redundancy payment or as compensation or damages was as it was described and was not actually a contractual payment or otherwise a taxable emolument. I therefore repeat my question and ask, do we need to check that pay-as-you-earn has been operated on all contractual payments and that we haven't failed to operate PAYE on wrongly described termination payments? Next, let me say more about potential problems where an individual has been treated as self-employed. And should we satisfy ourselves that this is correct? HMRC will always say that employment status is not a matter of choice, either for the individual or for the engager or potential employer. It is often a difficult issue, and perhaps it is difficult to draw the line between employment and self-employment. But unless it is clear that someone is self-employed and in business in their own right, I will ask the question as to what checks are being carried out to satisfy us that pay-as-you-earn did not have to be operated. Do we now need to put them on the payroll before we close it down? The HMRC online employment status indicator tool is not foolproof, but I will always use it. And if it gives me the right answer of self-employment, when I have answered all the questions truthfully, fully and correctly, I know that it will be binding on HMRC and I will keep a copy of that response on file for a future inspection. We also have the clearance option of asking HMRC to give us a decision. But if I refer you back to the Help Book E13 guidance, we are told that we have to operate pay-as-you-earn if in doubt and until we are told otherwise. So the risk is there. There is no time in this podcast to go through a lot of specific types of work. But I have already mentioned that HMRC accepts that window cleaners are self-employed and will not accept that an individual office cleaner is anything other than employee. Non-executive directors may be treated as self-employed for income tax, but they are officers by regulation because officers are treated as employed earners for Class 1 NICs. So let me ask the question. Have the non-executive director's fees been treated correctly? Or do we need to make an adjustment before the year end for Class 1 NICs on those director's fees? It could be that director's fees for acting as and providing services as a director are paid in addition to consultancy fees, which can properly be treated as self-employed income. But will this pass the scrutiny of an HMRC inspection? Is there a dual contract in place? Is there a genuine consultancy there? And can we prove that?